Bitcoiners, welcome back to FedWatch. I just had an amazing conversation with Tom Belongo. Actually, it was mostly Ansel. It wasn't even really me. I just kind of chimed in there at the end. But these two goats just went at it and talked all things macro. Tom has a very, very interesting thesis around Davos and what happens in Davos and the participants in Davos. We get deep into that along with a lot of other aspects. Tom is huge into Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space as well. So, you know, he definitely dropped his thoughts on what's happening in crypto and Bitcoin. And it's very refreshing to talk to a macro analyst that is also taking cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in particular very seriously. Ansel, what do you think of this show? I know you're a big fan of Tom.
Yeah, I wanted to have him on to talk about Davos, man. And we did that. I think I mean, there's too much to talk about in a short podcast, so we're going to have him back on. But this one, we learn all about what we concentrate on Europe, but we touch on the Middle East, we touch on China, we touch on Bitcoin, of course, and competing currencies. So this is a great episode.
All right, y'all. Well, hey, without further ado, let's get into this episode with Tom Belongo.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to FedWatch. Today, we're honored to bring on Tom Belongo. He is a geopolitical analyst, a macro expert, and I would say all-around freedom lover. You can find him at tomluongo.me, and he writes the Gold, Goats, and Guns newsletter. So welcome to the show, Tom.
Oh, good afternoon, guys. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invite.
I was just going to say, I remember reading you back probably 15 or 20 years ago on Lou Rockwell.
Wow. Wow, that takes me back.
And then I recently ran across your stuff on Zero Hedge talking about Davos, man, and I was just floored. And right. Now I've brought it up here on the show multiple times, and I think it is it fits perfectly into our kind of geopolitical analysis that we do here on the show. So I was just like, wow, we got to get Tom on the show. So yeah, welcome. You do a live stream on YouTube, is that correct?
Yeah, I do. But every Tuesday night at 9 o'clock. I've been doing this for about 4 years now. I started on Periscope, then we moved to, multi-streaming on like YouTube and, Periscope and DLive and like everything else, trying to move off of alternative platforms is difficult. So I'm now trying to, deprecate the YouTube channel as much as possible. I'll do a quick introductory stream tonight at 9, then I'll move over to my Odyssey channel for the main stream where I can speak a lot more clearly.
So I'm really interested in this. I am part of running a Bitcoin media company. Twitter CEO, who is very pro Bitcoin, is stepping down, and we're already seeing, censorship measures being put in place the very next day. I want to hear a little bit more about, like, generally, how do you look about making your content and your voice anti-fragile on the web? Because, like, it's difficult because the biggest audiences are controlled by the powers that be, per se.
It is. It's difficult. I mean, and I'm not particularly great at Twitter, right? So I've been doing Twitter since, 2010. I think I'm about to cross 8,000 followers on Twitter. And I think mostly because very early on, I'm sure that they had me shadow banned. So I was like hived off of my own little corner of Twitter. And, of course I attract people who don't have any following and who hate social media almost as much as I do. So, you got 6,000 people who follow you and they all have 20 followers, you get nowhere. Right. But it's finally starting to kind of break through that, that barrier. And I've actually been surprised that I've never been thrown off of Twitter or even like put in timeout. Cause I'm mean, I'm horrible. And at times I tried to get thrown off of Twitter and I couldn't do it. And it's kind of the same thing with YouTube as well. I'm like, I don't know what the gig is. I got 5,000 people follow me on YouTube and I do shows all the time. People who get, I do people's shows who have been thrown off of Twitter, locked out of YouTube, yada, 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 multiple times in the past, but somehow I've survived this. And it's not because, I'm a closet Fed or anything. It's literally, I try to get thrown off these platforms and it just doesn't work. I've tried using Gab. I've tried using other social media platforms. And I just ultimately, at the end of the day, the rubber band effect just takes you back to where all the people are. And I honestly think, though, I think Twitter is in trouble here. I think getting rid of Jack Dorsey, the guy who's now taking over, the soy boy who's taking over, is obviously it's clear now that they want to stop all journalism on Twitter And they just want it to be an echo chamber for Davos and for whoever, you know, whatever they think is the dominant narrative that they want to go out. And that's fine. And all that will do is eventually push everybody to some other platform. And that's fine. And I'll just follow, you know, I'll follow along where that takes me. And if it takes me to, you know, back the Gab, or it takes me over to Parler, or if that's even a thing still, I don't know. Wherever we wind up, we wind up. Because ultimately, I really do believe that the truth sells itself. Lies are hard to maintain. And so, you know, people want the truth and they'll seek it out. And, you know, once you have a big enough following, people will follow you around. I've never been able to create anything beyond that at this point, but I think I'm getting close to that critical mass. And, you know, obviously being able to do shows like this one and, you know, and just reach out to different audiences really also helps as well. So.
Excellent. And you mentioned there Davos, Davos crowd. And yeah, so one of the big reason why I wanted to have you on the show is to explain this Davos man theory or Davos man way of looking at the world. So who or what is Davos man?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And it's actually, we don't have time for it all, to be honest with you. I did a series of podcasts over the summer. I do a podcast as well. Gold Goats and Guns podcast. You can find it on Apple or wherever. I publish it through Spreaker. But I did three episodes, episodes 75 through 77, kind of explaining what happened back in June, specifically with the Federal Reserve and Jerome Powell raising the reverse repo payout rate by 5 basis points during the June meeting, which no one thought was important except me. And I'll be honest with you, everybody's like, "Hey, he did this thing." And then all of a sudden the euro dropped 4 points the next day and no one understood why. And I'm like, I know why. So I explained it in there because Davos is a multi-headed hydra of a variety of different factions that have all coalesced around the understanding at this point that the current monetary system and the current financial system is unsustainable, and they know it's unsustainable. And I'm kind of, in many ways, I'm riffing off of a lot of the things that Martin Armstrong's talked about over the years as well. So I stand on the shoulders of other giants this year. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to sit only, you know, bust my hand, pat my own self on the back. You read a lot of people over the years. I've been reading, you know, all the same people, I'm sure, that you read, Rickards and Daniel DiMartino Booth and all these other people for the last 15 years. And you get that sense that there's something different, right? And so what Davos is all the people who think they run the world gather together at Davos every year, and they decide on what the policy for the world is going to be. We're going to move towards central bank digital currencies. We're going to get rid of the two-tiered monetary system where the central banks create money and then it's distributed to the commercial banks eventually and gets into our hands. And that system is going to collapse because that system is unsustainable. And I think Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum sold a plan to the people who were going to lose all their power, be it the apparatchiks over at the European Union or the various factions of power within that exist within the US government, be it the neocons, the deep state, the MIC, you pick your poison. There's 7 or 8 different factions here. They all were sold the bill of goods by Klaus Schwab. We can fix this and we can keep you in power. But Klaus didn't tell everybody what the plan was. That's my theory. Okay. And I don't think he told the commercial bankers, the Goldman Sachs of the world, the JP Morgans, Bank of America, Wells, you know, all the European banks, that they were planning on getting rid of the commercial banks. And when that finally started to really become clear to everyone, and it was like probably the first couple of months of this year, and there was a pivotal meeting between all the central bankers back in May, and Lagarde, the head of the ECB, and Powell were there. And Lagarde got up there and started talking about how we all need to coordinate our monetary policy to fight climate change. And then Jerome Powell kind of stood up about 4 minutes later and went, no, I'm the head of the Federal Reserve and we have a twin mandate to, you know, for stable prices and full employment. And that's what my job is. And Lagarde got angry with him publicly. And there was a public spat between Christine Lagarde and Jerome Powell at a meeting. And I remember this was going on during the week that tensions between Russia and Ukraine were hitting their peak. And I remember telling my patrons, I run a Patreon that actually supports me. And I told them behind the scenes, I said, this note by Powell, this public spat between Powell and Lagarde is the most consequential piece of news of the week. Everything else is noise. And I turned out to be right. And, you know, I said at that point, I'm like, ah, the Russians and Ukrainians are not going to go to war. This is all brinksmanship. It was kind of clear that that was what was going to happen. And so everything kind of fell into place after that. Once I realized that that's where we were, and that I said at some point, Powell is going to have to stand up and defend the dollar if he's not the central banker for the world, if he's not a Davos man. Okay. And we're going to find out. And I have patrons who are professional traders. I have patrons who are professional fund managers and whatnot. And we all talked about who Jerome Powell is. And we all came to the conclusion that, you know, the moniker Private Equity Powell is real, and that he represents, you know, real Wall Street guys, real, you know, guys who believe in, you know, the traditional means of capital formation through, you know, the deployment of capital through the financial system as real. And we're not going to just throw that out the window and usher in global communism through central bank digital currencies. And I just firmly believe that. And once I came to that conclusion, once I did that analysis, we all kind of looked at each other and went, yeah, that seems right. And then everything since then has proven to me that Powell has been tightening monetary policy against Davos's will, against Klaus Schwab's will, against Soros's will, against, you know, all of the European Union. And it was very clear that's what he was doing. And at the same time, the Russians and the Chinese never signed up for any of this. At virtual Davos this year, Putin excoriated Schwab directly for the fourth industrial revolution, for you know, all of this stuff. He just said, look, this is just monumentally stupid. Like, if the people want that, that's fine. Well, we as world leaders can work towards that. But if the people don't want it, we shouldn't do this. And, you know, Putin excoriated him. Xi didn't even show up to the meeting, hasn't showed up to any major meeting since then. Neither Putin nor Xi have showed up since then, like to COP26 or any of the other big meetings. So that's to tell you everything you need to know, that the Russians and the Chinese are not down with this. I mean, they have their own agendas, and I'm not saying that their agendas are good, bad, or indifferent. They're just their own agendas. And so Davos never sealed the deal with everybody. And now the whole thing is starting to fall apart. And at the center of the storm is Jerome Powell.
Yeah, we've talked about Jerome Powell a lot on this show, obviously, but we've called him a straight shooter. And maybe that's because we felt a difference between, say, the way Powell would talk and the way Janet Yellen would talk. Right. Sure. And so this is going back probably 2 years now, when we were saying that, you know, Jerome Powell is a straight shooter. And then we saw him stiff arming the CBDCs. Mm-hmm. Where everyone else is really wanting to jump right into this crazy new world of digital sovereign currencies, I guess. And Jerome Powell was different. And so then when I read about this Davos man and how you were pitting this kind of the American Wall Street elites versus the European globalists, mm-hmm. I was like, wow, that is straight in line with how we're reading Powell.
Wow, that's cool. I wish I had been following you guys at that point. I would have been happy to, like, you know, retweet all of your, you know, I wish I had known about your show, to be honest with you. I spend so much of my day, actually, because I just feel like a lone wolf out in the woods, screaming at everybody like Cassandra, going, look, what's happening? And they're all like, yeah, you're nuts, dude. And I argue with people on Twitter all the time. I'm like, can you not see this? So that's really cool. And I'm glad to know that there are other people out there seeing the same things I am, because I literally fight with my own patrons, with everybody. And they're like, no, Powell's just he's just Davos through and through. I'm like, no, he's not. Because the first thing to remember, and I think you'll agree with me on this, is never listen to what a Fed chairman says. Only watch what he does. Okay. You know, a politician is lying when his lips are moving. You can almost say that about almost every other central banker, yeah. But Powell's a little different. And he'll tell you all sorts of silly stuff in order just to get through the meeting. But then it's policy that matters. So he'll say, oh, yeah, inflation is transitory. But notice how he keeps tightening down the international dollar flow by increasing the capacity of the reverse repo facility. Right. First, you know, he raised the capacity of it from $30 billion per counterparty to 80. Then he raised the rate by 5 basis points. Then then he opened up the foreign repo facility so that he now would have fine control over the flow of dollars and treasuries around the world. I mean, he has more control over the flow of U.S. dollars and U.S. treasuries than any Fed chairman has ever had in the past. And he's done it under the guise of, you know, bailing out the world. It's actually really quite brilliant when you stop to look at it. And I mean, I'm as hardcore libertarian, anarcho Bitcoiner as you could come up with. And I have to sit here and, like, you know, throw up in my mouth a little going, but I kind of have a hard on for the Fed chair. Like, this is kind of scary, right? I mean, it really has blown my mind that I've had to say this. I write another newsletter for Newsmax. I told my people over at Newsmax last month, I'm like, guys, this goes against every, you know, erg of my being and my training and everything else, and my Austrian economics bona fides and all of it, to say our best ally might be the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
I kind of agree with Jay Powell. Yeah, we've said that on the show here too. It's so hard to say those words, but you got to say them when true. They're true. So,
yo, what is going on, plebs? We're going to take a break from our programming to tell you about the resurrection of our print magazine, starting with the El Salvador issue. Starting this fall, Bitcoin Magazine will be available on newsstands nationwide and at retail stores such as Barnes and Noble. Don't want to get off your couch, though? No problem. You can also go to store.bitcoinmagazine.com. So skip the line and get each issue shipped directly to your front door with our annual subscription. I'm talking 4 issues a year that contain exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, along with powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Subscribe today and get 21% off using code podcast at checkout. That's PODCAST, podcast at checkout.
The world of crypto can seem like the Wild West sometimes. Soaring highs, crashing lows, celebrity shills, and new coins popping up seemingly out of nowhere every day. Look, we get it because we've been there before. At Bitcoin Magazine, we aim to filter out the noise and help newcomers concentrate on the signal. That's why we focus on Bitcoin only. Learning about Bitcoin may seem intimidating at first, but we've worked hard to break things down in a simple and digestible format that anyone can understand. Bitcoin Magazine has launched a free 21-day email course that teaches you about the fundamentals of Bitcoin. You'll receive one new lesson each day that covers a brand new topic as we guide you down the Bitcoin rabbit hole with quick and easy 3 to 5 minute reads. Not only do you get the free course, but everyone who completes the quiz at the end will earn some free Bitcoin. Start learning and earning Bitcoin today. Visit b.tc/21days to enroll.
Let's bring this back to Europe. Last week we did a European episode, and it was one of our most downloaded, I think, that we've ever done. And we've had some really good guests on the show, but this was just Christian and myself. We were just spitballing about Europe and people were loving it. So we called it like a perfect storm going on over there with the energy crisis, the supply chain issues, Russia, and all of this stuff. So what's your read on Europe and maybe the geopolitical circumstance that they find themselves in right now?
I think I wrote an article last week called "Have We Reached Peak Davos?" Right, and I'll be honest with you guys. I don't like taking credit for any of this stuff. I don't care about the credit, but it's pretty clear to me that 3.5 years ago, when I first coined the term the Davos crowd, no one was talking in these terms. Now today, Davos is everywhere, and they've had to cancel Davos for real because of the death threats. Like this is real. Like it's jumped containment. And I don't care that I'm the one who may or may not have been the one who started it or not. What I'm saying is that it's the reach of Zero Hedge, to be honest with you, how powerful that medium is, right? To plant the seed in people's minds and they'll make them reframe and rethink what they think they know. And that includes me. I mean, I do this on a daily basis. So what I think is happening in Europe is that I've been saying for years that Europe has always been the odd one out. You've got Russia and China on the one side, you've got the Federal Reserve and the United States on the other, and you've got Europe in the middle, and Germany is the pivotal country within Europe, right? And I mean, honestly, the last 150 years of American, of Western foreign policy has been, can we keep the Germans from siding with the Russians? Because they are natural economic allies and political allies, to be honest with you. And So everything comes down to that. And I think that that's where we are today. What I think is going on is Davos is trying to bring down a new Iron Curtain that that runs from Warsaw to Kiev to Istanbul, which is why Erdogan in Turkey is under, you know, is under extreme pressure down there. Why their banking system is under extreme pressure. Not to say that the Turkish banking system doesn't deserve to be under extreme pressure, but, you know, should it be as bad as we're as it is? I don't think so. I think Erdogan is not lying when he says that he's under foreign his currency and his regime is under foreign pressure. He deserves every bit of the pressure that he's getting because he's a snake. That being said, I think that's what they're trying to do without fomenting a war. But at the same time, what's happened is since the election in 2020, all of the factions that coalesced around, hey, we need to get rid of Trump in order to regain our in order to regain control of our power bases, that those factions are now working across purposes. They had a moment in time where they could get where all the Venn diagrams of all of their agendas, what they want, their wants, all coalesced around, we need to get rid of Trump. Right. Once Trump was gone, that moment in time, you know, they're all still moving along the same vectors. I want to go that way. I want to go that way. And now everybody is looking at each other going, we don't want what Klaus is selling. And so all that has to happen now is everybody just break off in the from within the cartel, if you call Davos a cartel of power brokers, and they all start working for themselves. And then the knives come out. And that's kind of where we are now. So Europe is the easy takedown. And it, all that has to happen is the Chinese runs a strong yuan policy. On the other side, the US runs a strong dollar policy. And that forces extreme pressure on the bankrupt European Central Bank and European Central Banks and European banking system, because they're all bankrupt. Okay. The only asset they have that they can use at their disposal at this point is the compromat they have on various politicians around the world and their gold reserves, right? Because the ECB marks its gold, all the sovereign gold that it's under nominally under its control to market. So while the Fed marks gold at $42.22 an ounce, which was the price that the Treasury sold it to in 1971, the ECB marks it to whatever it is today, $1,780 an ounce. So how does the ECB get out of the trap of rising bond yields, falling bond prices, because now the ECB's balance sheet is like 75% European sovereign debt? Well, if you know, you let the price of gold rise, now all of a sudden the ECB doesn't go bankrupt. Because remember, the ECB is not like the Fed. The ECB can go bankrupt. It doesn't have the ability to create unlimited amounts of elastic money like the Federal Reserve does. The Federal Reserve can print an infinite number of dollars. I'm not saying it should, whether its credibility will survive that process, but it can do so. The ECB cannot do that. All it can do is coordinate transfer payments within the European Union. Eventually, those transfer payments get so large that everybody's like, okay, well, no one believes these things anymore. And the only thing keeping the European Union afloat right now is Christine Lagarde buying every sovereign bond that she can get her hands on, right? And she's noticed how Powell has tightened monetary policy. Lagarde keeps saying that inflation is transitory and has continued to extend her bond buying program into the future. As a matter of fact, right after her spat with Powell, she doubled the rate of bond buying. Why? Because no longer did she count on the Fed subsidizing their profligacy. And so Europe is trapped, and they're also trapped for a couple other reasons. You have Germany that is absolutely cannot handle inflation, right? This is anathema to German savers and to German investors. And then you have places like Italy and Spain and Portugal that absolutely need inflation, but we can't have that, because if we do, then bond yields have to rise. And you've got a problem here where you've got France and Italy on one side saying we need we need to inflate, and we got the Germans on the other side saying you're not allowed to inflate. So then the big question for me this fall was, well, what would the German elections going to give us? Were they going to give us a coalition government that would allow for you know, the further into fiscal integration of the European Union under the auspice of the ECB. So what I think is happening now is the best pivot that Davos has is to allow at some point the European Union to collapse financially and keep a cap on inflation by locking all their people down over, well, now it's the Omicron variant of COVID, right? And, you know, and creating a two-tiered society, the vaxxed versus the unvaxxed, in order to keep GDP down and keep spending down and keep money velocity down, which will cap inflation. Now, of course, they're destroying the economy while they're doing so and everything else, and they're destroying capital formation, but that doesn't matter. These are technocrats. All they care about are their models, and all they care about is are their numbers that they can, that they can have the BBC and Sky News and Die Welt and all the rest of them say, oh, Trump, go, look, we've got inflation under control. There's no problem here. No, there is a problem. Nobody's working. You're not producing anything. You're all going to starve. And if you don't starve, you're going to freeze to death. And then you're all going to die of the common cold because none of you have any immune systems because you're tired, hungry, and cold. Like this is the fundamental problem. We don't have that problem here in the United States. We have the opposite problem. We have a bunch of traitors in the White House who are desperately trying to destroy our economy by raising energy prices and through legislative fiat, destroy the ability of the United of anybody to accumulate and maintain capital here in the United States. That's why they wanted the wealth tax. That's why they wanted all this stuff, because they wanted to make the United States worse than France. If you can imagine that, right? France is like one of the worst places in the world to put to base a business out of in order to grow capital. The United States, on the other hand, is the exact opposite of that. They weren't literally with the infrastructure and Build Back Better bills. They were trying to make us worse than France in order to, because they understand as well as I do that capital flows to where it's treated best. So if you make the United States uninvestable, then by default, everything has to, they would think that some of that money will at least stay in Europe and won't run out of Europe, flee out of Europe. At the same time, I also believe that what they're actually trying to do is foment a war between the United States and China diplomatically in order to create even more incentive for capital to flee the two warring countries. And where is it going to go? It's going to go to the one geographical area that is not at war. So it's this very dangerous game that they're playing, where they want to create a new Iron Curtain between Eastern Europe and Russia so that the eastern part of Europe, the Visegrads, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, Poland, and Germany, along with the Black Sea states like Romania and Bulgaria, that they all stay within the auspice of the European Union because they destroyed and everybody's trust in the Russians, but not actually start a war. Okay, they want a Cold War. They want a new Berlin Wall, for all intents and purposes, a new Iron Curtain. They can do that, and then also get the United States to force the Chinese into saving face over Taiwan and start a war between the United States and Taiwan, which neither country will survive economically. Because look, go back to World War II. Why did the United States become the destination for capital during World War II? Because it was the only place not being bombed. Okay. That's why the United States became the center of world finance post-World War II. We were the only ones with an economy and with an infrastructure that can actually run anything. So the plan is obvious: destroy the world economy and then build it back better with the application of cheap money and centered from the place that was not bombed and not destroyed. And in this case, it would be Europe.
That brings up a real subject I didn't know if I wanted to touch on, but I'm going to go for it. And that is, so Afghanistan. Okay. And I think that this was it was sloppily done, but it was a geopolitical move to, I think the U.S. is moving back towards some sort of pre-World War II non-interventionism, and we don't want to be world policemen anymore. And so
you're close. I know you're about halfway there. That's not actually what is happening. What's happening is we're going to pull out Mackinder Heartland theory, which has been governing U.S. and British, which is also the Brzezinski Doctrine, the Wolfowitz Doctrine. This is all the same thing. A lot of this stuff comes from the Brits. Okay, we could touch on it. We could spend half an hour talking about the Brits and their involvement in all this. But the goal here is that, yes, the United States needs to pull back from the empire of chaos, as Pepe Escobar put it, all across Central Asia. So we're going to pull out of Syria. We're going to pull out of Iraq. We're eventually going to pull out of NATO. We're deprecating NATO at this point as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we can't fight a war on multiple fronts. We can't do this, but all those assets need to be redirected towards China and AUKUS. And that's what AUKUS is all about. So NATO depreciated, AUKUS on the rise, and you can see the play, but in inimical British style, like, you know, talking about the end of the British Empire, during, you know, circa 100 years ago, you leave nothing but conflict and minefields and poison pills all across the region for the powers that are there that they have to clean up. So Afghanistan, yeah. The pullout of Afghanistan and the subsequent policy measures like freezing all their assets, stealing their assets, cutting them off from, you know, foreign capital and everything else was designed to leave a cesspit that the Russians and the Chinese would have to deal with. Same thing with Ukraine. They're trying to destroy Ukraine in such a way that it leaves a failed state on Russia's border. They're trying to leave Syria balkanized. They can do that. They're even willing to balkanize Turkey, to be honest with you. As long as they can control Ankara and they can control access to the Black Sea, they don't care about the eastern half of Turkey controlled by the Kurds. As a matter of fact, they would love for all of the Kurds to rise up and create Greater Kurdistan.
So, Tom, you're saying when you say they, you're talking about predominantly Western European leaders that all congregate at Davos with other powers as well.
With other power structures, you also have the neocons within the U.S. State Department and DOD, and within U.S. intelligence services as well. You also have Bellingcat and the MI6 and the old British aristocracy who believe in this stuff as well. Like, they're all part of this. They're all various factions of Davos. And then you have the World Economic Forum. And then you have, you know, then you have people like George Soros who just fundamentally believe we should do away with the nation state because it's the nation state that's created war. The guy's insane. He's also got dementia. And Martin Armstrong wrote about this a couple of weeks ago. And that was a very good blog post by Martin about that, because that's something I hadn't considered, is that Soros is probably in the throes of dementia the same way that Biden is. And therefore, when people start falling into dementia, they get very violent and they get very aggressive. And Soros's behavior in the last 6 months or so has been really erratic. And you can see that in the organizations that he nominally controls and moves around. So
yeah, I wanted to bring it back to this, the Eurasian heartland theory is, okay, so Afghanistan happened, and when Davos man saw Afghanistan,
yep.
I think they kind of started pissing their pants a little bit and saying, oh my gosh, no one is going to stop Russia. If Russia tries to take Ukraine, if Russia tries to, you know, push, if Belarus wants to start something on the border with Poland, no one's going to stop them. And I think when
no one can stop.
Yeah, yeah.
But so the thing is that the Russians don't want this. I've been studying Putin for 10 years now. And I can tell you that you can take Putin at his word that he doesn't want to take control of Ukraine. Why would the Saker talks about this all the time. The Russians barely want to take control of the existing parts of the Donbass that have broken away, Lugansk and Donetsk, because they're already a massive drain on the Russian state economy and everything in order to rebuild them. Okay. If they were to formally become part of the Russian Federation, now this is something they have to deal with. Okay. It's the same thing with, they don't want to take over Ukraine because it would be a massive drain on them financially, which they can't really afford at this point. In 5 years, 6 years, different story. But as of right now, no. And so when Putin says all of this is being done to limit Russia's growth, he's being serious. So the Polish Belarusian border skirmish is completely manufactured by Davos, again, to further poison Polish relations with their neighbors to the east in order to bring them back into the fold within the EU and then bludgeon them with gas transit through Nord Stream 2. When everybody talks about Nord Stream 2 being a political weapon of the Russians, nonsense. It's a political weapon of Germany. Because at the end of the day, the Germans control the flow of gas because it goes to Germany. What used to go through Ukraine or to Poland directly into the Baltics directly now goes through Germany. And Germany is the one who can control that. Poland, you don't get gas through the Opal pipeline or this pipeline. We're not going to send it to you unless you dismantle your constitutional court, unless you elect the right leaders, yada, yada, yada. This is what's coming. Okay.
So What is then, how do you tie this into your idea of a future of a euro? Because I believe that the euro is going to go down, obviously, against the dollar. It might even break up. And what that means for Bitcoin and what that means for the dollar, like if capital is fleeing the eurozone because of all these geopolitical pressures that are going on, what's your take on the dollar, the euro, and Bitcoin?
Okay, so let's start with the obvious one. Today, Jerome Powell came out and put a fork in the European Union. They said, "Oh no, inflation is not transitory."
Fill me in on that because I didn't see that.
Okay, right. Yeah, no. So Powell was speaking today in front of Congress. At 10:30 this morning, half an hour before the European close at 11 a.m. for November, Jerome Powell comes out and says, "Yeah, we're going to have to like do away with this idea of transitory inflation. It's structural," because Powell's going to get reappointed because Wall Street wants him to be reappointed. Lael Brainard will not be appointed Fed chair. She might not even be appointed as vice chair, because over the weekend somebody leaked that she's married to Biden's Asia czar, who is in bed up to his eyeballs with the CCP. I wonder who that was. Jerome Powell? Maybe it was Wall Street. And look, this weekend, Goldman Sachs wrote a piece about Omicron COVID 9/11. I'm calling it now Omicron vid 9/11 because it's now COVID 9/11. I've always called it that. Saying, what is everybody doing? Goldman, usually whenever Goldman says anything, I said, just take the opposite side of the trade, because Goldman is usually short if they say they're long, and they're long if you go, you know, but this was not that normal. This was an honest, like, what in the heck is going on? So I think Goldman didn't know about the Omicron full court press and the bombing of the markets that happened on Friday after Thanksgiving. So, which then set the stage for Monday, where we didn't get follow through downside action. Right. Powell comes out and says, look, he's been renominated. He's going to sail through the Senate. Okay. He'll sail through the Senate with 60 votes. No problem. Over the weekend, it comes out that Brainard is like, you know, up to her eyeballs with the CCP. She might not get confirmed as vice chair. Okay. When Powell did that today, he pretty much put a fork in the Build Back Better bill. He destroyed Pelosi's speakership. He's now set the Democrats on a path to destruction. Now we saw that after he said that today, all the markets dumped, because now everybody's expecting the Fed to taper more aggressively, QE, and then probably raise rates like the bond market wants it to sometime no later than June, right? And we're already, last week we were talking about no rate hikes until 2023. I got news for you. By January, we're going to be looking at rate hikes by the March meeting. Okay. Maybe June. March may be a little aggressive. Maybe. Because it's that big. It's that big a deal. I honestly believe that they understand, that these guys understand the problem, and they're going to kill. They're trying to kill Europe. So the euro is going to continue dropping like a rock. It's also going to put upward pressure on bond yields, because at some point Lagarde will run out of everybody's forbearance that she has control of this market. Because at the end of the day, the ECB is not one tenth as powerful as the Federal Reserve is, period. So if the Fed wants to squash the ECB, the Fed can squash the ECB. It's just that simple. So that means the dollar is going to continue going up. It means that the euro is going to crash, and we're going to finally get the sovereign debt crisis in Europe that's been foresaw for about 11 years now. When that happens, all that capital is going to flee out of Europe. It's all going to go into U.S. assets. Some of it's going to flow into Russia. Some of it's going to flow into China.
And Bitcoin.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt, Bitcoin and gold. Don't kid yourself. Gold is going to take a hit here. Because everybody's selling gold for dollars because it's very liquid. But the central banks are all adding gold. I saw something this morning that Singapore very quietly over the summer bought 25 tons of gold. So Singapore is like the last country on earth I would have ever expected to add to their gold reserves at this point. Okay. But even there, I know the Singaporean monetary policy really well. I used to study Southeast Asia. Okay. And I know how important I know the Monetary Authority of Singapore pretty well. And this is a needle scratch. Okay. I wrote about this for my patrons this morning. I wrote a freaking 1500 word article for them this morning about this. So previous to this, the countries that were all buying gold for their central bank reserves, Poland, Hungary, even Japan, right? The Czech Republic, Serbia, all the Kazakhstan, the Russians, all the people within the orbit, nominally within the orbit of Russia, who have their own individual currencies. Remember, Poland still has the zloty, they're not in the euro. The Hungary has the forint. That's not going to change unless they get rid of Viktor Orban. Like, these things are, so they're all shoring up their currencies against a currency collapse. But they all know what's coming. And so central bank buying of gold is now represents 15 to 20% of the annual gold demand, by the way. This is a big deal. This has been this way for about 2 or 3 years. And it's not just the Russians buying anymore. So now with Bitcoin, everyone is going to be trying to figure out how they can get around the capital controls that are coming, how they can move money cross border, how they can move their money anonymously now with Taproot in place. Like, now people can, between Taproot and Lightning and everything else, they can just, at the end of the day, these people all think that they can do the chain analysis and send us tax bills over the internet and scare us. I'm like, I'm going to tie that up in court for 5 years, and you might get your money that you think you're going to get from me 5 years from now after because that's the speed at which an IRS audit works, especially since their interpretation of U.S. tax law on what is actually a taxable event is very murky. Currently, you've got a guy like Gary Gensler over the SEC refusing to approve a physical Bitcoin ETF, even though everybody else is starting to do so. Like, and then we got El Salvador selling Bitcoin bonds, and they're gonna build a city based on Bitcoin. I mean, dude, it's all happening. This is happening, and these people are like, even the BIS has admitted that they're 5 years behind the curve, and the BIS is all the Bank of International Settlements has all but admitted that crypto's already won. Okay.
Bitcoin's already won.
Well, Bitcoin.
Yeah. The hydro shit will be unstoppable for them too, because I don't think that they're very competent.
Yo, my fellow Bitcoin lovers, have I got something specifically curated for you? The Deep Dive is Bitcoin Magazine's premium markets intelligence newsletter. This isn't some pay group shelling buy and sell signals. No, this is a premium Bitcoin analysis led by Dylan LeClaire and his team of analysts. They break down in an easily digestible way what is happening on chain, in the derivatives markets, and in the greater macro backdrop context for Bitcoin. This newsletter turns volatility into a joke. So hit up members.bitcoinmagazine.com and use promo code podcast for 30% off the Deep Dive. That's members.bitcoinmagazine.com, promo code podcast for 30% off. Divorce your pay group and learn why Bitcoin is the ultimate asset by Dylan and his team. My fellow plebs, the Bitcoin conference is back. Bitcoin 2022, April 6th through the 9th, is the ultimate pilgrimage for the Bitcoin ecosystem. The Bitcoin conference is the biggest event in all of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. We're leveling up and making this bigger and better than ever. I'm talking straight to the moon with the 4-day long festival in the heart of Miami at the Miami Beach Convention Center. This has something for everyone. Whether you are a high-powered Bitcoin entrepreneur, a core developer, or a Bitcoin newbie, Bitcoin 2022 is the ultimate place for you to be with your people and celebrate and learn about the Bitcoin culture. So make sure to go to b.tc/conference to lock in your official tickets and use promo code Satoshi for 10% off. Want more off? Pay in Bitcoin and you'll receive $100 off general admission and $1,000 off whale pass. Those are stackable. So go to b.tc/conference and attend the best conference in Bitcoin history.
Ansel has a pretty interesting take on how Bitcoin's going to kind of play into this European crash. And again,
I want to hear it.
Surprisingly, we do talk about, kind of like Europe being the weakest link here on the show a lot.
No, Ansel, I want to hear what you have to say about this. It'd be great.
Yeah, basically what I said there was that as capital is going to flee Europe, now a strong dollar is bad for the global economy because it makes everyone's debts go up. And so the powers that be, maybe smart Davos man, maybe smart Wall Street guys, whoever, they're not going to want to move that capital within, you know, a short period of time, say 6 to 12 months. They're not going to want to move it into the dollar or dollar denominated assets. That's where I think Bitcoin sits very pretty, mm-hmm. that this is a very liquid global asset that you can send, you know, within 10 minutes anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And I think that's going to be, that's my main thesis for how the crash of the euro is actually going to help Bitcoin dramatically.
And it's very clear that Wall Street wants in, because Wall Street doesn't have a traditional, their traditional lending models are dead. Like the traditional business models for the commercial banks are over. Like they need products to sell and they don't have them. So they want to be able to create their own DeFi projects that they can sell to Muppets. Like, you think Goldman doesn't want this? Absolutely they want it. You don't think JP Morgan doesn't want this? Of course they do. Personally, I think that right now, I think Morgan's on the side of Davos and Goldman's being shut out because of this investor note that I saw over the weekend from Goldman tells me that there's something going on there. Obviously, Wells has been on the outs for years. They've been willing to sell Wells out forever. And BofA and Citibank, I think, are also kind of, you know, it all comes down to Morgan. And I think Morgan gets the nod because Morgan is intimately entwined in the CME LBMA manipulation of the gold market and the silver market, which is, you know, it's also tied into this. Look, the best thing that's going to happen here is that the central banks are all going to go along gold to try and save themselves. Okay. At the same time, that's going to signal to everybody, you need to be in hard assets and you need to be in safe haven assets. And where can you get positive yield? Well, gold is nice, but Bitcoin is better. Like, it's all good. And this is why we're seeing the kinds of things that we're seeing like DeFi projects like Olympus paying 7,000%. I mean, like, it's insane. People don't know where to put their money. Right. I'm not dissing Olympus or anything. I own a little bit of it. I'm not dumb. Right. You know, someone's gonna pay me 7,000%. I'm gonna like throw some money at it. Right? I'm not dumb. What I'm saying is that in the search for yield, people go to where their capital is treated best. And it's clear that there's capital inflow into the entire crypto space. It's also clear that Davos and the powers that be are trying to divert capital away from Bitcoin, which they can't corrupt, towards something like Ethereum, which they can corrupt. Okay. Now Davos is all on board with Ethereum. They love the idea of there being, you know, $122 friggin' smart contract invocation fees on Ethereum. They love this, as opposed to Lightning, where you can trade, where you can move, you know, where you can move money around for sats, right?
That's where they're going to host their CBDC on Ethereum, probably.
Yeah, they may, you know, and that's fine. I happen to think Ethereum is interesting from a capital inflow perspective, but I also think it's, you know, probably one of the worst software projects I've ever, you know, seen since Microsoft Word or Microsoft Office. Therefore, you know, because it's kludge. And that's, again, and it's the same thing with Bitcoin. I love Bitcoin, but I'm not married to Bitcoin. I'm no Bitcoin maxi. Because I fundamentally believe that, and by the way, I know like the original Bitcoin maxi, like the guy who Vitalik Buterin accused of being a Bitcoin maximalist all those years ago on this podcast. Like, I know this stuff, and like, he's not even a Bitcoin maxi. The because competition is always what drives innovation. So we have Taproot because of Monero, for lack of a better term. We have all of these innovations on Bitcoin and the Bitcoin improvement protocols because of the competition of other coins that look at Bitcoin. Well, it doesn't do this, so let's do that. Let's differentiate ourselves in the market that way. Great. If Bitcoin can add that on and do it well, technically, and do it as well, if not better, than its competition, well, then Monero will fall off to the wayside and Bitcoin will win. But if it doesn't do it well, then something else is going to take it. Then something else will take market share. And eventually Bitcoin will realize, and the Bitcoin devs will realize, that you don't need to be all things to all people. You don't need to be the only reserve currency of the crypto space.
Yeah,
we would actually be better off with a basket of currencies.
I don't know about that. We definitely side a lot more on like the monetary maximalist and the Bitcoin maximalist thesis. But With that being said, I personally am well known in the space, I guess, for kind of being a very open-minded and benevolent Bitcoiner to what I call the Hydra of shit, which I think is a very useful tool to, you know, take down the powers that be. So I don't think that the crypto Hydra of shit is like something that's bad for Bitcoin. But, no, I don't. You know, I don't really see it like really monetarily competing with Bitcoin either.
I mean, look, I'm open to all of this. I like Bitcoin. I like, but I'll be honest with you, I like Decred, guys. I think it's a phenomenal freaking project. Like, I know the lead designer. I think it's an excellent project. I think in many ways it's a better project than Bitcoin. And if Decred pushes Bitcoin to becoming better in terms of governance, yeah, then I'm all for it. But I think that there are real issues. And again, it's like everything else in the world. I think that we cannot be married to any one thesis and always have to be willing to reassess on a regular basis where things are going. And if I'm wrong in the long run about Bitcoin maximalism, hyper Bitcoinization, whatever, happy to be wrong.
You know, hey, I love that you're into it. Like, fuck yeah. And I mean, the information that you're sharing on your channel and on this show is absolutely stellar. And I think that's fantastic. We do want to get your take on the recent China banning Bitcoin move. I'm curious if you looked into that and thought about that at all.
So how many times is China ban Bitcoin?
Many times, but this is definitely the most serious time.
Well, that's fine. And I don't think it'll matter. I really don't. We're all veterans enough of Bitcoin to understand that TCP/IP sees routing issues as a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
Like, I've been in this internet thing since I was in college in 1987. Okay. I've been, you know, telnetting into friggin' to Unix servers since I'm 18 years old. Yeah, it was to play friggin', you know, Empire and Silly Mud, but it doesn't matter. What's important here is understand that this is never, they haven't been able to shut down the Pirate Bay. They haven't been able to shut down any of the stuff. They never will. If they were going to shut down Bitcoin, they're going to only be able to do it, but through financialization measures like they've done to gold. And what I've been saying is very simple. They don't control the Bitcoin. Therefore, they don't control the market. They control 95% of the gold. That's where most of the gold in the world is controlled by the central banks. And so therefore, they can control the price of it through financialization and rehypothecation through the futures markets. They can do that. They have that control because they have control of the supply. They do not have the control of supply of Bitcoin. Therefore, they don't have control over it. And they're never going to get control over it. And so, and even if they do get control over it, this is again where any good, hard Bitcoin style proof of work freaking coin, like, oh, you got control of Bitcoin. Well, fuck you. We're all moving over to Monero or Decred or pick another one. Doesn't matter. We can just shift.
Hard fork. Yeah.
Done. Fuck you. We're out.
Yeah.
So you won that round. Okay. So then we play blockchain whack-a-mole. Like, are you kidding me?
I wanted to throw a bug out here for this one. China, you know, kind of shot themselves in the foot back in the late 19th century with the silver versus gold when that all happened. And I think they could be doing the same thing again. And it could just be in that maybe the Chinese nature to hold on to the past too long and they're going to get screwed in the end. So I don't know. I think that they might be serious about this ban. Eventually they will have to change, but in the meantime, it could be over the next decade, it could be a really bad situation for them.
Okay. So I agree. And Martin Armstrong actually wrote a very interesting post about this recently. It was one of his private blog posts talking about China. And he had someone asked him about this. And he said, and it was an interesting point because, you know, Martin's been saying for years that, you know, that by 2032, China is going to be the financial center of the world because of the political collapse of the West. That's not a thesis I disagree with. Okay. I can see that coming. At the same time, what he was saying, which was salient, which is that China seems to be going backwards, right? They're not continuing to open up and embrace Deng, the reforms of Deng Xiaoping. They're going backwards and going back towards a more authoritarian model. Now, maybe that's necessary for today, right now, because of the the rest of the chaos around the world. China's political stability as of right now is an asset, just like Russia's political stability is an asset. It undergirds people's confidence in the yuan. It undergirds people's growing confidence in the ruble, right? Political stability is what creates currency stability, okay? And so, yeah, while I while I'm not crazy about, and none of this is, you know, comports with my view of the world, I don't want to see China do this. I would like to see China continue to open up, but they're not doing, if they're not going to do that, well, it just limits the time that they're going to be, quote unquote, in power. And so, yeah, I your point is well taken, right? That they're this is part of the Chinese mindset, and it may, you know, the Chinese authority mindset, that this is where they're headed. It is what it is. Like, that's okay. You know, it, we're going to move on without them if necessary. And I think that crypto, you know, offers the opportunity for real, honest to God movement away from these authoritarian structures. And there's going to be a lot of mistakes, and there's going to be a lot of shit coins, and there's going to be a lot of people make a lot of money and lose a lot of money in shit coins. And there's going to be a lot of bad projects. 90% of them are all garbage, right? But that's not what's important, because we know where the high quality assets are, right? And the high quality assets are the ones that are under accumulation in the long run. And a real financial system will be built on top of it. I think we need to have a certain layer of shit on top of the, you know, it's like there's gold, and then there's, you know, and then there's commodities, and then there's stocks, and then there's real estate, and then there's derivatives and all that stuff. And the normal run of things, if you're thinking in terms of Exeter's pyramid of the inverted pyramid of the monetary system. Well, you can build the same model for crypto. And I actually did so. I actually, you know, ran a very early version of this back in, ran an article on this back in 2017 talking about this. I'm like, you know, it's fine. And I'm okay with that. I think that as long as something winds up being the reserve asset, and even if it's a basket of currencies, basket of cryptos that compete amongst themselves to for investor capital in order to continue to improve the underlying technology to improve our trustlessness, its trustlessness and its stability, right? And its sovereignty, right? And to improve the sovereignty and and to improve the sovereignty of the money itself, okay, that means adding privacy, adding this, adding all of these things. When we get to that, and governance and all the rest of it, when we get to that state, and I think that that's, we're still in the very early stages of this, we're going to have an anti-fragile system that precludes, you know, Davos man from thinking he has the ability to take over the world.
Yeah,
I'm convinced of this. It's just how many people are going to die in the process.
And how many people are there? And I agree. I mean, it sounds like, I don't know if you've read The Sovereign Individual, but
I mean, but I've read enough Murray Rothbard to, like, you know, choke a horse, guys. Like,
it's not Murray Rothbard. You definitely need to read it. Published in 97, and it's about the transition into the internet age. So I think like it really wraps around a lot of the ideas you just spoke. What I think is the most important book for anyone to read. I'm also curious if you've heard of Nick Bhatia's Layered Money.
No, I haven't, actually.
So yeah, I mean, maybe that interests you too, just because you kind of talked about the layering of the financial system and the future financial system. Tom, would love to have you back on the show. This is absolutely fantastic. And you're right, you can definitely go. So you told us that before we started recording, and you definitely lived up to your word, sir. But a lot of alpha, and we're excited to get this out later this week, and again have you back onto the show. Ansel, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, we'll have to get you back on, Tom, to talk about why we are bullish on the U.S. From the geopolitical angle, I'm very bullish on the U.S. and. So that would be a very interesting conversation to break it down, U.S. versus the world. I can't wait to get you back on. Maybe in 3 months we could have you on quarterly or something. That'd be awesome.
Whenever it works for you guys. I mean, I'm available all the time. Just, you know, when this is ready, just, you know, send me a link to it so that I can post it on my blog, and we can go from there. And I'll try and embed this article. I'll try and embed this into an article. We get it on the Zero Hedge, and let's make it all work better for everybody. Because that's the whole point. So, all right.
Good. Love to hear it. Well, again, Tom, thanks so much. Tom, I guess, where can people find more about you? You mentioned Zero Hedge. You mentioned your blog. You mentioned a lot of different places. tell our audience where they can learn more.
Let's make it simple. You can follow my blog over tomluongo.me, Gold Goats and Guns. I have a Patreon that you can sign up for on there as well, where I do twice weekly video podcast market reports, where I do technical analysis of important markets along with talking points of the day. So they run anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes, along with private blog posts for my people, my patrons as well. I call them morning munching. So, you know, my goats go out in the morning and they munch and I troll the headlines and figure out what I'm going to talk about. And that's usually 2 to 3 times a week as well, along with the monthly newsletter where I have a full portfolio stock portfolio and crypto portfolio designed around this thesis. And we do that once a month as well with my partner, Dexter White. I have a podcast. Again, you can find all this at the blog, all named Gold Goats and Guns. And you can follow me on Twitter at TFL1728. And that's the best way to get a hold of me.
TFL1728. All right, let's go. You guys can follow me on Twitter at CK_snarks. You can follow the podcast and everything that Bitcoin Magazine does over at bitcoinmagazine.com and at Bitcoin Magazine on Twitter. And you can follow Ansel at Ansel Lindner. Again, Tom, really appreciate you coming on the show and excited to have you back on. And until then, guys, stay well, peace, stack the dip. You know the drill.